Let's pick up our story in the book of Genesis, chapter number 3, where everything went off the rails. Chapters 1 and 2 is all about the beginnings of the perfect creation, that everything that God made was very good. And then Satan comes on the scene for the very first time. He seems to have been a cherub, an angelic creature of God that was serving there in the Garden of Eden, who, for reasons we can only speculate about, suddenly rebelled against God and against the creation made in his image and likeness, against humanity. And so Satan, either in the image of a serpent or a dragon, or compromising this creature, this animal, comes to Eve and begins to lead her down the path of temptation. So let's go ahead and read again the inspired text, Genesis chapter 3, starting at verse 1, and then pick up where we left off in the story yesterday. "Now the serpent was more crafty than any other beast of the field that he who is God had made. He said to the woman, 'Did God actually say, you shall not eat of any tree of the garden?' And the woman said to the serpent, 'We may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden, but God said, you shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the midst of the garden, neither shall you touch it, lest you die.' But the serpent said to the woman, 'You will not surely die, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil.'" So Satan takes the first shot in the war that we're still in the midst of today, the spiritual war between what we're soon going to be referring to as the seed of woman and the seed of the serpent. Satan against mankind. He lies. First, he asks the question to get the mental wheels turning for Eve. Did God put any restraints on you? Oh, he did? Well, guess what? He lied as to why he put those restraints on you. He just doesn't want you to have things as good as him. And so this causes Eve to now go down that rabbit hole that we know of, temptation to sin. Verse number 6, we see her thinking process, which is similar to something we see in the New Testament when it describes how we fall into sin. And this is what it says in Genesis 3:6. "So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food," so first of all, she had personal experience. All of these trees around here, all of them have fruit on them. All of that fruit is wonderful. It's very good for you because that's the way God made it. Well, this tree does also have fruit. Why wouldn't it be good for you? "So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes," you know, it was something special. It was pretty. It was desirable. Just like all the other plants in the garden, no doubt they also were pleasant on the eye. And they tasted great. They were very good. Why wouldn't this one be? And final part of the temptation, "and that the tree was desired to make one wise." Now, Adam and Eve were not created stupid. They were not absolutely ignorant at the very beginning. They were not empty vessels. When they were created, they had some sort of base knowledge. We know this because the first task that Adam is given is to name all of the animals that are brought before him. And he has no problem doing that. He has no problem expressing, communicating verbally with God. And now, clearly, he's been communicating with his wife, with Eve. So these folks had already a good basic wisdom given to them directly from God. But now she has been told by Satan, the liar, that she's missing out on something. There's still more. And God has said, this is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The Greek text actually uses a word for knowledge here that has the express indication of learned or experiential knowledge, things that you learn firsthand. So she may have had some sort of concept of evil. That means it's the opposite of all the good stuff that I know about. But she'd never experienced it. And so this tree was placed in the Garden of Eden, as best we can tell, as the mechanism by which Adam and Eve could have a genuine opportunity to express their free will. They could look at this tree and say, God said, don't touch it, don't eat from it, so I'm not going to, because God knows best. That would have been the proper exercise of their free will. That would be faith, trusting God. But in order for free will to exist, you have to have the opportunity to do differently than what God would want, which would be to choose to trust in Satan's lie and to actually consider that God might be holding out on you, that God might not have your best interests at heart. And that seems to be where she goes. Like so many of us that have been told by God, don't do this, it's a bad idea. So she took of its fruit and ate. So she becomes the first one to give in to temptation, and the New Testament talks about that, and it's part of the reason for the penalties that come up later that we're still under to this day. She also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate. Now, there's a lot of debate back and forth about what this phrase means. She gave to her husband who was with her, meaning in some people's minds, he was there and heard the whole conversation between her and Satan and went along with her. I don't think that's what it's talking about here. I think it's simply saying, hey, the only other person that was with her in the Garden of Eden was her husband. And so she eats of this. She has no ill effects immediately. So she takes some of it, goes to her husband, and I believe engages him in the same rationale that was used by Satan to her. Because temptations can be spread this way. When somebody tells us that we can engage in sinful behavior and benefit from it, sometimes we go and recruit people with the same sort of argumentation. And so that's what happens here. And then he is left with a free will choice. What should I do? So he ate. Both of them sinned. They each sinned in a slightly different way. She sinned as she fell into the wiles of the devil. And the New Testament kind of talks about this, that she was tricked. Adam, though, when he is presented to it by his wife, he apparently at least has the opportunity to consider the ramifications of this, but goes ahead and sins anyway. And so he sins with a very clear will. He knew God said, don't even think about eating of this fruit. And so he goes, I'm going to do it anyway. And so penalties will be brought upon him for this as well. And we'll talk about those penalties being still impactful upon us. They are the consequences that impact upon all humanity. Now, what's the immediate response at this point? Verse 7. Then the eyes of both were opened, and they knew they were naked. Now that comes from the last part of the last chapter, when everything was very good, and the chapter ends in verse 25 saying, "And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed." Here, that suddenly changes. Now, why? I think it's related to this psychological response that all of us have when we engage in misbehavior, when we deviate from the norm, from the community standard. We suddenly feel shame. And part of the shame response is to not want to be seen in that situation. You can see this really clearly in kids. When they do something that is off the norm, and everybody is kind of looking at them in the midst of that, and they get embarrassed and they start saying things like, "Don't look at me!" Or they cover themselves, they pull something up over their heads, or they cover their face with their hands, or they run away and hide underneath a table or in a closet or something like that, because they don't want to be seen, because something's wrong. They sense it in their very being. We have the exact same responses even as adults. And so this is the very first time that psychological reaction takes place. And it is expressed in their realization that they are different from one another. The only physical difference between the two of them at this point, when they are fully toned, fully muscled, they are in their perfect physical form, the only real distinguishing characteristic between the two of them is their genitalia. And so their reaction is to grab some leaves off of trees. The tradition is it's fig leaves. And the verse says, they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves loincloths. So they made some sort of covering for their genitalia because they were embarrassed. Verse number 8. They heard the sound of He who is God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. Cool of the day is literally the wind of the day. The expression seems to be about the changeover from the evening, from the afternoon to the evening to night. We've talked about how in the original creation, the environment seems to have been perfectly balanced, and that just a slight variation in temperature as we go from daylight to dark, and then from dark to daylight, that's what causes the mist to form, the dew point to be exercised, and this is what waters the entire garden. Well, this would also have an effect upon the movement of the air, that a slight change in pressure would bring up a wind as the termination point is approaching on the face of the earth. That is the place where daylight and dark are divided. And so God comes visiting as the day is coming to a close. And the impression seems to be that this is a habitual thing, that He is there on a regular basis to fellowship with them. But on this particular day, because they have sinned, they don't want to see Him. The same embarrassment, the same sort of psychological reaction that caused them to hide their genitalia from each other is now causing them to want to hide from God as He comes to visit. So the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of He who is God among the trees of the garden. Now God is perfectly aware of what's happened. He has ultimate foreknowledge. He is God. He is omniscient, as we say. He is all-knowing. But He is also a parent. He has created them as his children. And so he deals with them in a parental type fashion and asks them questions that he already knows the answers to. Verse number 9. But he who is God called to the man and said to him, "Where are you?" So God comes walking in the garden. Adam and Eve are hiding out in the bushes in their new loincloths, and they're not answering. Where are you? And finally, when God doesn't give up, Adam comes out. Verse 10, he said, "I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself." And he said, "Who told you you were naked? Have you eaten of the tree of which I commanded you not to eat?" So why are you having this emotional reaction? Why are you feeling that there's something not right with your body? You've eaten of the tree, haven't you? Now, God, of course, already knew that. But we need here confession. The first step in fixing our deviation from the norm, fixing our sin, as we've come to call this moral deviation, the first step is admitting what we did, admitting the wrong. The word confession means to say the same. It's to acknowledge, I sinned. God gives Adam, and by extension Eve, a chance to fess up, to acknowledge they did the crime. This is always a problem, isn't it? Because we don't like that. We don't want to admit we're the problem. And this has always been an issue throughout history, even to this day. When we deal with children in their immature growth stages of dealing with life, when they do something wrong, they don't want to acknowledge it. And we have to teach them it is important to do so. I know when I have disciplined my own son, and then when I was a teacher in school, I was disciplining other students that had done things incorrectly. I always said, "You need to tell me what you did that was wrong. Explain to me that you understand what the problem is." And after that, I would hand out the penalty. Often it was a timeout in which I would say, "You need to sit still by yourself. Keep focused on one thing only. Why what you did was wrong and how you should avoid this in the future. How it is important that you don't deviate from the instructions in the future." So God is actually acting again as a parent and as a teacher with Adam and Eve and gives them the chance to do the right thing about having done the wrong thing. Fess up. Verse 12. The man said, "The woman whom you gave to me, she gave me the fruit of the tree and I ate." Oh my goodness. This is unbelievable, isn't it? Two big mistakes, actually three if you want to count the refusal to confess at the very beginning of it. But he goes on and does something that, again, many of us have engaged in, and that is blame. Blame somebody else for our problem. And so he blames too. He blames, first of all, his wife, never a good choice, especially when she's standing right there listening in on the conversation. And then he blames God. It's her fault. And by the way, you're the one that put her here. So it's your fault too. This is going to have something to do with the penalties that will be handed out in a little bit. And something that is still prominent in the New Testament and the way we structure our homes and the way we structure the leadership in our churches. And I'll talk about that. Verse 12. That's what we just read. So verse number 13. Then he who is God said to the woman, "What is this that you have done?" Giving her the chance to confess, to say very simply, "Sir, God, Creator, I screwed up. I did the wrong thing. I ate when I shouldn't have." That would have been so much better. But instead, she passes the blame as well. The woman said, "The serpent deceived me and I ate." Now, it is true, he engaged, that is the serpent, engaged in misbehavior. He lied to her. He contradicted God. And he also offered to her a reason to believe that God was holding out on her. So he is certainly at fault. But here's the issue. She didn't have to believe the lie. She did not have to believe that God didn't want what was best for her. So she's at fault for not having faith in God, not trusting God. So both Adam and Eve are equally culpable for their choices, their free will choices, and that is why they will be punished and why consequences will be set in place. As a reminder, sin always has consequences, so don't sin. But Satan is at the beginning of this because he's behind the serpent, or is actually the serpent. So God begins with the originator of sin, the liar himself, the hater of mankind, the one who wanted to attack the ones who were made in the image of God to try to destroy their relationship with their Creator. So God begins with him as the consequences. Verse 14, "He who is God said to the serpent, 'Because you have done this, cursed are you above all livestock and above all beasts of the field. On your belly you shall go, and dust you shall eat all the days of your life.'" All right, so this gets back to something I talked about yesterday, where I find myself really uncertain as to where to fall into this understanding of the words. Is this by the standards of a lot of traditions in many different cultures the reason that snakes slither on the ground to this day? That somehow previous to this event, no snakes slithered on the ground. They all either had legs or wings, perhaps both, but they were up off the ground. And that because the serpent was used by Satan, perhaps free will choice of the serpent to give into this, because the animals seem to have been much more intelligent in the very beginning of time, and I think we'll probably go back to that, more expressive, more rational. So is this the penalty that was now placed on all of serpents because of their participation in the sin here? And that's another reason why we don't like serpents, because of all of this. Or, as my seminary professor said, this is a Middle Eastern reference to the punishment of subservience of Satan. That because he stood up against God, he was going to be forced at some point in the future to get down and acknowledge that he was in the wrong and that God was in the right. And that this is a punishment against Satan. And so we can kind of see both sides of that picture, I think. And that's why I am caught between the two. And so I leave it to you to kind of chew on that. And we move instead to the more significant thing that we're going to end on today. And that is the first reference to the atonement that will fix the problem. Verse number 15, I will put enmity, which is a fancy word for saying a state of warfare. I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and her offspring. So there's going to be this constant state of warfare. Some of the tradition says it's between humanity and serpents. And most people don't like snakes, right? Where I grew up, people killed snakes anytime they saw them, sometimes even if they were completely harmless snakes. Probably not a good choice because they have a place in the balance of nature. And so I don't do that anymore now that I'm grown up and realize that. But that is true, that seems to be very widespread. But the more important thing is that this is the state of warfare between Satan and humanity, between his deceivers, his angelic horde, which we talk about as being demons, fallen angels, and all of us who are made in the image of God, and we are being targeted still. So that state of warfare existed for a long time. But then comes the prophecy, he shall bruise your head, that is the seed of the woman, will bruise the head of Satan, and you shall bruise his heel. The word for bruise here has the sense of snapping or hitting, and it's the same word both times, and I appreciate the English Standard Version acknowledging that. So this is the reference to Jesus will destroy Satan at the cross, but Satan will kill Jesus at the same time. So this is the first reference in Scripture to the atonement, to the fact that Jesus died for our sins to defeat the penalty of sin, which is death. And so we will reference back to this over and over as the promise of God's salvation was there from the very beginning of sin.